Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, who is that guy that's at the controls? He's unfamiliar to me. At any rate, we're glad that you could be listening here this morning as we talk with a scientist from the University of Illinois, and we're going to talk about the honeybee. Now, it could be that you would be a little bit surprised if we told you just how important bees were, unless maybe you're just a big fan of the product that they make. The fact is that the bees, honeybees, are very important here in our economy and in our food supply. They're very important because they're pollinators. They're also very important as research tools for scientists who study disease, who are interested in studying development, even who are interested in studying behavior. Well, this morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking with a biologist here from the University of Illinois. His name is Gene Robinson, and we'll be talking about a research that he and others have been involved in to decode the DNA of the honeybee and to talk a little bit about what scientists hope to learn about human health and behavior by studying bees. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Our guest, Gene Robinson, is the G. Ahrens Professor of Integrative Biology. He's also Professor of Entomology, so that means he's a scientist who studies insects. He's Director of the Neuroscience Program at the University of Illinois and Theme Leader and Professor at the Institute for Genomic Biology. Glad to have you here.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And as I just I just asked you just before we got going whether you have always been someone who was interested maybe personally and also professionally in bees, and you said yes for a long time.
Yes, ever since I was 18 years old and working on a kibbutz, an accidental exposure to bees and beekeeping led me on my path.
And then so that's always been a major study throughout your education and even now in the work that you do in your lab.
Yes, yeah. I studied bees as an undergraduate. I knew I was heading in that direction, and then studied bees formally in graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you just a very general kind of question. Why are bees important among the many, many different kinds of insects that one way or another play a role in our lives? Why are bees important?
Well, I like to think of honeybees as overachievers. They're tiny creatures. Their brain is the size of a grass seed. And despite their small size, they have outsized impact on the world. You mentioned already their importance as a pollinator. They are, let me just expand on it, they are the most important pollinator on this planet. In America alone, they account for some between $10 to $20 billion a year worth of food due to their pollination activities. Then on top of that, they are very compelling and very interesting and important, as you said, research models in diverse areas in biology. So all of this, and then on top of it, producing honey to the delight of people, all of this in this tiny creature makes for a real overachiever.
Mm-hmm. Just if I could, sort of as a side question before we get to the genome project, from time to time, there are reports in the media that raise concerns about bees and how they are doing. Given the fact that they are that important, particularly as pollinators, if something came along and did something to dramatically cut down the numbers of bees, that would be something you would really, really want to be concerned about. How are bees doing?
Well, funny you should ask. They're not doing that well. There has been something that has really affected their population. This is a parasitic mite that is an invasive species, comes from another part of the world. And this mite has helped primarily to reduce populations as much as 50% in America over the last 15 or so years. Mm. So a recent report from the National Research Council has documented that this mite has had this devastating impact on the honeybees.
Yeah. It's my understanding that really you were one of the people that was instrumental in getting the honeybee genome project going. And that there are only a couple of other insects that whose genetic material has been mapped. The fruit fly is one of them. the mosquito that carries malaria is one of them. So we would, and that's understandable why, you know, for the one, given how important it is for scientific research, and for the other one, given the fact that it's an important vector for a serious disease, you would say, okay, I can understand why you would do those. Why the bee?
Well, it goes back to my answer before. When you sequence the genome of the honeybee, you are going to get a lot of bang for the buck. You are going to get the resources to help improve pollination. You are going to get the resources to do research to shed light on a variety of biological areas that the honeybee is used for. So again, it just fits perfectly with how important the honeybee is in diverse aspects of agriculture, society, environment, biology.
Mm-hmm. Is this, I'm sure from time to time when people hear stories about various projects to do this kind of thing, whether you're talking about human beings or you're talking about some other animal, mammals, insects, whatever, I'm not sure that people really understand what exactly it is you do, how it is you do this. What exactly is the process?
The process of sequencing
the genome?
Of
sequencing the genome, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the genome resides, if you will, inside each and every cell in our bodies and the bodies of all animals and inside every cell and every organism. So what you do is extract the material, the DNA, and then the current practice is to take the DNA and chop it up into millions and millions and millions of very small pieces. Those pieces are then sequenced very rapidly using the state-of-the-art technology. And then you have millions and millions and millions of pieces of DNA that have now been sequenced, and now you have a puzzle. So then you have to put the puzzle together. The technical word for that is you have to assemble the genome. And the way you do that is with big, brawny computers and very effective computer algorithms. And you don't sequence the genome just once. You sequence it as many times as you can afford to sequence it. Then what you do and what these programs do is align these various pieces, which will have lots of overlap because you've sequenced the genome many, many times. And you've been sequencing and you've been chopping up the DNA into tiny pieces randomly. So the program assembles the genome, and now you have a genome that is not 100%, but more or less in the correct order. So you've got all the letters in the right order. So you now have the equivalent of a book, but just with one huge run-on sentence. And then the next job is to annotate the genome. So to use the analogy that I just made, punctuate it, if you will. And the annotation involves saying, okay, where are the genes? Where does gene X begin? Where does gene X end? When does GY begin? And attach meaning to this string of millions and millions of nucleotides, of bases, of letters, and begin then to identify what are the features of the genome. Where are the genes? What are the genes? Are they similar to other organisms? Are they different to other organisms? And so forth. So that's the process: sequencing, assembly, annotation.
And this particular effort, the one for the bee, there were a number of people, different institutions, different places around the world even, that were involved in all of this.
Yes. So the sequencing right now is concentrated in just a couple of facilities. There are only a few facilities that have built up the technological expertise and just have invested in the infrastructure to do the sequencing in a big way. We paired up with one of the premier sequencing facilities in the country at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. So that part is very centralized. But then after that is done and after the assembly is done, which is also something that usually is done by the sequencing facility, the annotation and the analysis of the genome was a decentralized effort and was involving people from all over the world, 150 scientists from all over the world, using their own expertise in particular areas of biology to bring to bear on what is the honeybee genome, what does it tell us.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just to make sure that I understand that the very first thing what you're doing is that you have a map in the sense that you've laid out, say, okay, here are the chromosomes, and on each chromosome here are the genes, and they come in this order, and there's X, and there's Y, and there's Z, and whatever it is. But then there's also another step that has to go beyond that, where you look then at those genes and say, what does this one do? It's just because you have mapped them and you could say here they are and here's where they live, that's still going to be a big step between that and being able to say what all that genetic material does, what's coded for in that material.
Right, exactly. For that, we draw initially on what's known from other organisms. So we are in the middle, not in the beginning. We are in the middle of the genomic revolution. There's a lot of information out there, especially from the organisms that have come before us in this case. And you mentioned one very important one, the fruit fly, that has had a lot of genetic research done on it already. So we have this information. Why can we use this? Well, one of the most important and amazing insights to be gained from biology in the latter half of the 20th century is how conserved genes are. How many genes have conserved function when you go across diverse organisms? And that's just another way of saying how important and central to all of biology is evolution. And this is a manifestation of that. And so we can then take advantage of that information. So if gene X is involved in a particular molecular function in the fruit fly, then we can take that as a great starting point in the honeybee, even though there's been perhaps no research on that gene yet in the honeybee. But we have a leg up on the situation.
So I don't mean to put this too crudely, but you could say in one organism, you could say, we know this gene has something to do with the way the eye is formed. So that would give us good reason to believe that then in another organism, that same gene probably would also have something to do with the way the eye is formed. So then you might have to go out and do some work just to make sure that that is true, but that at least gives you a start to say, well, probably because it works this way over here in this different animal, you could say, well, there's probably a pretty good chance that it works that way over there too. Now, and across species, do you see that same kind of pattern repeated?
Yes, you're exactly right. Across species and across great spans of species, big distances between organisms. So a gene involved in the development of the eye in the fruit fly is its cousin in the mouse is also involved in the development of the eye, even though the two eyes, the fly eye and the mouse eye, structurally are very unrelated. So that's what I mean by this amazing insight of how conserved genes are across evolution.
So even you're comparing insect species and mammalian species, that similarity of function is there.
Yes.
Even though they're really in fruit flies and mice are very different.
Yes. And in fact, the anatomists would say that the eye of the mouse and the eye of the insect, or the vertebrate eye and the insect eye, are not homologous structures. That is, they do not share an immediate common ancestor. And despite that insight based on anatomy, we see at the molecular level great conservation that basically contradicts that statement that I just made about what the anatomists thought about mm-hmm. the eye. We see conservation.
How much similarity is there between, say, the human DNA and the DNA of a bee?
Well, at the absolute DNA level, it varies a great deal. There are hundreds of millions of years of evolution separating those two, and there is so much divergence at the DNA level that if you were to line up the DNA of a human and the DNA of a honeybee, you'd have a really difficult time navigating, finding what's what and what the overlaps are, because there are so many changes in some of the letters, some of the nucleotides. However, if you look at the parts of the genome that encode proteins, which are the most best studied parts of the genome at this point, and what we would say, at least at this point in time, the business part of the genome, if you can align those parts by converting the nucleotides using a computer program to protein, the amino acid sequence, then you can see a lot of conservation, a lot of similarities. So you can find the human cousin of a honeybee gene and vice versa for many genes.
So it would not be unreasonable to say if you look at genes and what they do in bees, that it would not be unreasonable to say, well, that would help, it would aid in your understanding of looking at genes, similar genes, and what they do in humans.
Yes, but with an important qualification. Now I have to get a little nerdy, perhaps even a little more nerdy, and that is to make a distinction between molecular function and a higher level biological process. So the particular molecular function of a gene is very well conserved. If it's a gene that orchestrates the regulation of other genes, like a transcription factor, as they're called, if it's doing that in the human, you can be pretty darn sure it's going to be doing that in the honeybee. When we get to higher levels, which are called biological processes, that's where you have to perhaps use it as an insight and as a starting point, but not as a given.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Gene Robinson. He's a biologist here at the University of Illinois. He's professor of entomology, meaning he's a scientist who studies insects. In his laboratory, they look at bees. And we're talking here a little bit about some of what we're learning about bees, and particularly some of what comes from the results of the decoding of the DNA of the bee. The completion of the project's been going on now for a number of years. In a sense, it was kind of officially the completion just kind of officially announced recently. We have the opportunity here for you to call and ask questions. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, apparently, among other things that you have learned from doing this study is something about the origins of the bee. That is where bees came from, and that do I have it right that this in fact challenges or supplants what previously had been the thought about what the point of origin, I mean, geographically speaking, what the point of origin of the bee was?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is research that was part of the Honeybee Genome Project that was headed up by Professor Charles Whitfield, who's a professor here at the U of I in our entomology department and the Institute for Genomic Biology. And very, very exciting findings. The honeybees in general are known to have evolved in Asia. And it was also thought that the Western honeybee, which is the most prominent species of honeybee, the honeybee species that we have in this country, the only honeybee species we have in this country, also evolved in Asia. But Professor Whitfield's research, the research of his colleagues, has shown that while an ancestor of the Western honeybee evolved in Asia, the Western honeybee itself seems to have an African origin. And then it left Africa in actually not one but multiple waves to colonize Europe and other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. So it starts out being a tropical species, creature.
Yes, yes. And it retains a lot of its tropical characteristics, but it has adapted beautifully to other environments.
Well, that was exactly what I'm thinking of, the fact that they can survive in places like central Illinois or points more northward, a great tribute to their adaptability, considering the fact that they started out in Africa.
Indeed, indeed, yes. So there are many species that don't live in societies that have achieved cosmopolitan distribution throughout the world, also attesting to their adaptability. Mm-hmm. In the case of the honeybee, we have a truly cosmopolitan species, and we can attribute some of their success in that regard to their sociality. So, for example, because they live in a nest and work together to modify their environment, they're able to maintain rather stable environmental conditions. Honeybees both air condition and heat their house, their beehive. Mm-hmm. And they do this via some exquisite socially coordinated behavior.
Well, I want to make sure that we get to this subject of social genes and social behavior, because that's, I think, particularly interesting in one of those places where it starts you thinking about what you can learn by studying bees and how that you can apply that to human beings. setting that aside for the moment, what are there some other important things that so far, in addition to maybe something more about bee origins, are the important things that you have learned so far as a result of the DNA, the decoding the bee DNA project of this particular bee? There are other bees as well.
Quite a few things, as they say. Don't get me started. We could go on for a long time about that. I'll just give you a couple of highlights in addition to what we've spoken about. Some research, part of the Honeybee Genome Project led by Professor Hugh Robertson, also here at Illinois, has shown some very interesting differences in the size of a couple of gene families. So oftentimes, genes with similar molecular functions, there will be more than one such gene in a genome, and so we call those gene families. And what Professor Robertson and his colleagues have found is that the genes that encode the receptors for smell, so that enable an organism to smell, the olfactory receptors, that gene family has gotten very large in the honeybee relative to the fruit fly. And conversely, the family encoding the receptors involved in taste, the so-called gustatory receptors, has gotten quite small. So we see quite a bit of difference in the genomic basis of some really important sensory processes when we compare these two insects. And as Professor Robertson has pointed out, this makes a lot of sense with when you consider the bee's social life. So insect societies are all about chemical communication. There's a lot of chemical communication going on that helps integrate the individuals in a society. In addition to that, honeybees use their sense of smell in order to forage efficiently, in order to find flowers, to learn the aroma of particularly rewarding flowers so they can return to them, and they use smell in very important ways. So an expansion of that family makes perfect sense. Why might we have a reduction of the gustatory receptors? Well, that one's perhaps a little bit more speculative, but a very plausible suggestion is that, unlike many insects, the honeybee does not have an antagonistic relationship with its food. It's not chomping down and munching away a plant. It's not vectoring pathogens. It enjoys a mutualistic relationship with its food. Plants that produce flowers need bees, and bees need flowers. It's one of the most spectacular and well-studied cases of coevolution that we know of. And so plants that are producing flowers, they're attracting bees. They're not trying to produce chemicals to kill the bees. So maybe the honeybee doesn't need a food taster like an unpopular king might. Maybe the honeybee is able to sample the food, taste the food, acquire the food from the environment without that, if you will, fear of having to worry about are there poisons out there to avoid. And so less reliance on taste. So that's speculation, and that's the kind of thing that the Genome Project does, is it gives you these new insights, it gives you these new results that lead to new ideas that can spur research to demonstrate, is this the case, or is there another explanation for these interesting findings?
Yeah. All right. Well, we have some callers here to talk with. We will start out talking with someone in Charleston, and this would be on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, great program. I see relationships between the bee and what humans could be. my question is, some time back there was a huge epidemic among honeybees, I think in the Midwest. Am I right on that? There was some virus that attacked the honey and people who collected honey for sale were affected by that. And do you know anything about that, or if that has passed or the honeybee is rebounded?
Even at this point in time, there are problems with viruses. The mite that I spoke about earlier possesses or carries viruses, it weakens the honeybee and allows viruses that have normally not been so potent to cause problems. However, I have never heard of any virus that affects bees that also affects humans. I've just never heard of that at all.
Well, Well, I didn't. I didn't mean to say that they're passed on to humans, but among the bees themselves. And then I just can't remember exactly, but a few years back there was this huge die-off of the honeybee, and it was localized within the bee community, and then a lot of them disappeared because of that. But, well, perhaps I'm off on that.
Well, I mean, it could be that we're talking about the same thing. The mite has been the main culprit for die-offs the last few years, and recent research has found that viruses are playing a role in the mite's devastating effect. So it's not all the mite, but it's sort of a 1-2 punch with the mite and some viruses. So that might be what you're talking about.
Well, it sounds pertinent.
Yeah.
And the last thing that I'm interested in human behavior, and you look to the bee and other species, you know, that seem to cooperate and get along and are not as vicious as humans are. And somehow, if we've lost that ability, you know, to have any regard for each other, which seems to be the case, you know, in dominance and all of that, and whereas the other species, even, sea life and on the land and such, you know, that humans seem to be unable to control their aggressions and such and work that on each other. But a very interesting program, but I think you've answered my question. So, and thank you very much, sir.
All right. Bye. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on here. We'll talk with someone in Kankakee next on our line one. Hello.
The term plant hierarchy has been applied to the social organization of bees, plant hierarchies being seen as perhaps instructive as something useful in social organization among people. Is the guest in a position to discuss plant hierarchies? Thank you.
I'm sorry, I don't think we quite understood. What kind of hierarchy, again, are you talking about?
Plant hierarchies.
Flat hierarchies?
Correct.
Uh-huh. So I think you're talking about decentralized organization. Is that correct before I go on?
Yes.
Yes. So you're absolutely correct. Honeybees have been used to look at the role or the potency of decentralized organization. And the basis for that is that honeybee colonies act as integrated units. A honeybee colony makes decisions. It changes its behavior in response to changing conditions. And yet, although the lights are on, no one's home. That is, there are no leaders in a honeybee society. The queen does not run the show. She does not tell the workers what to do. There's no executive committee that is telling everyone else what to do. There's no chancellor, not even a provost. So the question is, how is the colony able to respond in an integrated way when there are no leaders? And so a variety of mechanisms have been studied in different sort of contexts, different social contexts, different colony contexts to explain that. So you're absolutely right. This is something that is a very interesting area of study. It's related to the whole science of complexity, and honeybees have figured in prominently in that.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. We'd welcome other questions as we talk with Gene Robinson. He's professor of entomology here at the U of I, is also the G. Ahrens Professor of Integrative Biology. He's director of the neuroscience program at the university and theme leader and professor at the Institute for Genomic Biology. And we're talking some about the recent results of the effort to decode the DNA of the Western honeybee, one of just a couple of insects for which this has been done, and what it is that scientists are learning about bees, and then looking at this question of whether there are things we can learn things from bees and studying them and their makeup that can be applied to human beings, giving us a better understanding of ourselves. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit more about this issue of behavior and genetics. And I think that people understand the idea that genes are involved in determining structure, the way that we're put together, what we look like, the reason that people's children look like them. It's about genetics. Then, though, there are another set of interesting questions. Some people might find them troubling questions, maybe, about other things that are maybe genetically determined. And we get into this question of, could behavior somehow be genetically determined? And in this particular case here, we have bees. They're very social, as you've explained. They, within the colony, people, different individuals have different functions. And what's interesting is that over time, different individuals will perform different functions. And then you have to ask this question, well, okay, how do they know how to do this? It seems that here you can point to a connection between genes and behavior in the sense that these sorts of changes in function, the programming that goes with knowing how to do this other job, is that genetically encoded?
Well, many aspects of bee behavior are innate. That is, bees are born able to perform a particular job. The basic social system that you just said is innate. Bees change jobs as they get older. But one of the important lessons that the bees teach us is the interplay between the environment and the genome. So bees change jobs as they get older, as you said, but the rate at which they change jobs depends on the needs of the colony. Normally, a bee will work in the hive for 2.5 to 3 weeks. Then she sort of graduates and becomes a forager. But if there are a shortage of foragers in the colony, if a colony lacks foragers, some of the young bees will speed up their maturation and become precocious foragers. So you have this innate tendency to grow up and change the activities that you perform, but that system interacts with the social environment, with the needs of the colony, to be modulated. And the lesson there is that there is a dynamic interplay between the genome and the environment. And so you have genes that influence behavior, and then you have behavior and other environmental conditions that in turn influence genome activity. And so it's a dynamic interplay. We see it both ways. Emphasizing one without the other has been done at various times in history, mm-hmm. And is incomplete. We need both.
I suppose that would maybe provide some relief to people who are concerned about genetic determinism. And I think, as you say, it's absolutely true that over time, as we've thought about this question of, well, why is it the way we are? Why is the world – why is it that various creatures are the way they are? We've sort of swung back and forth between this idea that everything is programmed and that everything is determined by environment. And perhaps now more and more we're coming to the greater appreciation that it is not one or the other. It is both, and that it is possible for certain things to be, in a sense, written on us. And yet without the right kind of environmental triggers, those things that are written aren't going to happen. So that there is this very close relationship between environment and behaviors. Even though behaviors might in some sense be encoded, the right stimulus has to happen for those things to come out.
Right. That's really well put. And just to add to that, you've developed it very nicely conceptually. We're able now to take this to an experimental level because of the genomic revolution. And so I can just modify what you said very slightly with still capturing the spirit, and that is it's all about the genome. There are hereditary influences on the genome. That is, you inherit different versions of genes, and that's the static part of the genome, the DNA. But then there are environmental influences on the genome that influence when and where particular genes are going to be activated, how active they're going to be. And so this dynamic interplay between nature and nurture can be seen at the level of the genome. Hereditary influences on the genome, which are evolutionary, which are inherited over time, and environmental influences on the genome, which are very dynamic in real time, responsive to changes in conditions.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that given enough time that you will get a better understanding, let's say, again, we'll just confine ourselves to bees, about this particular mechanism, about how it is over time that a particular individual will take on these different kinds of jobs depending upon the right kind of environmental trigger. Do you think that you'll actually get to the point where you'll really understand how it is that in a real sort of almost molecular way, you'll actually understand how that works, what parts of genetic material are responsible for that, and how they respond to environment? And do you think the time will come when you can, in a sense, sit down and say, okay, I can explain to you how this happens and kind of map it all out?
Well, we've gone a long ways in that direction already. That's one of the major focuses in my lab. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more to learn. But I think with the tools that we have at hand now because of the genome, I like our chances of being able to achieve that kind of understanding for this social behavior.
Yeah. Does that – you talked earlier about the fact that bees are very important for a variety of reasons, but maybe the big one is that as pollinators they're very important. And so it's in our interest to understand them as well as we can and make sure that we do, you know, whatever we can to make sure that they are healthy and they continue to go on and do their thing. Is there some relationship between understanding this kind of thing and being able to understand bee behavior as much as we possibly can and its structure and makeup? Does that somehow refer us back to or give us some sort of a tool if what we're concerned about is the general health of the species because they're important and we want to keep them in the environment?
There are relationships specifically to pollination performance. So the bees that are the pollinators are the ones that have made the transition from working in the hive to foraging. So if we know everything that we can about how that transition is made, under what circumstances, what genes are involved, what environmental conditions trigger which genes, and so forth. If we understand that cascade from society to individual to brain to genes to gene networks, then we might be in a position to manipulate that and have more foragers come out at particular points in time. That might not be great for the honeybee colony, but no one's asking them when they're rented for pollination. The point is to have as many bees out to pollinate as is possible, because pollination occurs for any particular crop over a very short period of time. And so then you just want to have as many bees out there as possible. Sometimes the pollination of a crop depends on one afternoon of perfect weather to get the bees out there.
Hmm. So it's conceivable that for the various functions, for the things for which we value them, it's possible that we might be able to nudge things in a certain direction so we could get more of that. And for example, if you say what we want is we want more pollinators, we could do that so we could get more bees out there doing that. I suppose if the only thing that we're concerned about is honey production, is it possible that you could also do something to make them more productive?
Yes, because again, manipulating the size of the foraging force, it's the foraging force that produces honey. Mm-hmm. So there historically are great synergies between basic research and applied research in honeybee biology as well as in all areas of biology. And so we always have that hope that these discoveries can be extended in those directions.
Mm-hmm. Has there been much in research into genetic engineering of the species in order to produce what we would consider to be more desirable characteristics that would yield us more of the end from what it is that we think is important from that?
No, not really. We've lacked the genomic resources to do this, and just some of the breeding issues with honeybees are complicated, and so it hasn't been an area of emphasis up to now. There's a hope that with the genome, while there may not be genetic engineering of new strains of bees, I mean, that's a topic that, you know, deserves a show and you've covered in other contexts. That's complicated for a variety of reasons. So that really isn't on the table. Mm-hmm. The idea that is on the table is using insights from genomic-enabled biology to identify genes and pathways that could be manipulated a variety of ways.
Yeah. Well, what other I asked earlier about the kinds of things that you have learned so far, and you said if you don't get me started because there are lots and lots of things, and so we talked about the origin issue. We've talked about this particular thing where you've realized that there is indeed a kind of a biological basis for the fact that bees have a highly developed sense of smell, which makes a lot of sense when you look at how they live their lives. Maybe not such a highly developed sense of taste, because it's just apparently just not all that important. And that you that those things are genetically coded. Are there other things, maybe not things that you have learned yet, but things that you think, as somebody who is particularly interested in bees, that you would really like to know, that you that now having done what you have done so far with the DNA, that that at least gives you a leg up to knowing, getting at these sort of things, that you would still say, well, these things I would still really like, I would really like to know these things about bees and how they're put together.
Well, one area of particular interest to my lab deals with the whole question of how does the social environment regulate gene activity? So we've talked a little bit about this dynamic interplay between genome and the environment, and in particular honeybees as obligate social animals, very sensitive to their social environment, as we've discussed. So we're very interested in really dissecting the process of social influences, taking that all the way down through the communication systems of individuals into the neural functioning, the individual's brain, and then ultimately in the nucleus of a neuron inside the brain of an individual, how is it that the social signals result in turning on or turning off certain genes to coordinate the behavior? Social regulation of gene expression is a topic that's very important from the perspective of mental illness. Many diseases that involve deficits in social interaction, ability to read social situations or disproportionate effects of social environment. So it's an important topic in health. And the honeybee, as an obligate social animal, with so much of its behavior influenced by its hive mates, by its society, is very well positioned to be a great model there. So with the genome, we can now look for the parts of the genome that are involved in gene regulation. Mm-hmm. And we've started this already in a collaboration with a computer scientist at the University of Illinois, Professor Saurabh Sinha, starting to look for the parts of the genome that are involved in regulating the activity of other genes. This is something that we couldn't do until we had the genome, and is a very fertile area for research that has, I think, very broad implications.
Well, that's a remarkable sort of idea, that somehow by greater understanding of the social behavior of a bee, that you could actually learn something that might be beneficial, that you could apply to mental health of human beings. That seems to me to be such a big, it's a fascinating idea, and also seems to me to be a pretty big leap.
You're right. And notice I said nothing about gene X doing this in bees and therefore doing it in humans. I spoke about the process, a general biological process of how is it that environmental signals, in this case from the social environment, ultimately get transduced into a signal to turn on and turn off different genes. Mm-hmm. That's a process that, if we understand it in one organism, in its generalities, we will be able to draw insights that could be useful in other contexts and other organisms.
Sure. Well, when you're talking about the bee and you use a phrase like social environment, what exactly does that mean? I'm having a hard time imagining what the different features of the social environment that might change and that then might influence the genes, which then might in turn influence the behavior, would be. Mm-hmm. For a bee, what constitutes the social environment?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. Let's talk specifics. So we spoke before about the social organization and the fact that they work in the hive when they're young, and then they graduate and become foragers. And I added to that that there's flexibility, and if you remove all the foragers from a colony, some of the young ones speed up and become foragers precociously. That's the social environment. In this case, the age demography of the society. So if you change the age demography of the society experimentally, that is, you experimentally remove the foragers, or if a calamity befalls a colony naturally and its foraging force is decimated, you now have changed the age structure, the age demography of the colony. The bees respond as if they've taken a census, or as if they've read the Wall Street Journal, and have perceived a shortage in labor. We know that's not the case. Instead, we have been able to decode part of that process. Foragers produce an inhibitory pheromone that slows down the maturation of the young bees. If you remove the foragers, you remove that source of inhibition. And we know that this pheromone affects the brain activity. And an experiment that we're just getting ready to start in the lab is to look at what genes exactly does this pheromone turn on and turn off to mediate this change in behavior. So the answer to your question is, in this case, the social environment would be the age structure of the colony. How many really old bees? How many middle-aged bees? How many young bees?
Hmm. Oh, so in a sense, demographics is one important feature. Mm-hmm. How many individuals and what age individuals?
Mm-hmm.
What other sorts of things are there?
Well, I think some of our listeners, and perhaps you've also heard about the famous dance language of the honeybee.
Mm-hmm.
When honeybees go out and find a food source, if it's really attractive to them and if it's really attractive to the colony, and that's where I'm heading with this comment, mm-hmm. if it's really attractive to the colony, when they come back to the hive, they will communicate this. They will dance, which encodes the distance and direction of the food source. So they're out there. They make their own quality assessment of how good the food is. Is it sweet? Is it easy to get? How far away it is? And they hold that information. That's part of the story. Then when they come back to the hive, they interact with their social environment in a very specific way. When they come back to the hive, it's as if they turn on a little timer. If when they arrive at the hive, they're mobbed at the entrance by individuals who want a little taste of that food, let me have a little bit. No, let me have a little bit. They're mobbed at the entrance very quickly. Their probability of dancing and telling their sisters about this food goes up. In contrast, same bee, experience the same food source in the environment, same sweetness, same distance, ease of handling, and so forth, come back to the hive and they get the cold shoulder. No one's there. No one's asking for any food. Their probability of dancing goes down. So they integrate their own information with an aspect of their social environment, in this case, how interested other bees are in what they have brought home, and then that shapes their decision on to dance or not to dance.
Now, this is very interesting. Does that actually, I'm not even sure we could talk about the things on that level, but does that actually affect their, does the social feedback that they're getting about how desirable whatever this is have, does that actually, in a way, affect their assessment of how desirable it is? I mean, or can you not even, am I way off?
No, it's a fascinating question. It gets at the whole concept of reward and what is the representation of reward in a brain, in a honeybee brain, in a human brain, for that matter, a topic of great interest in studying drugs of abuse. What is that representation? Is it a single representation that multiple inputs feed into it, or are there multiple reward systems that interact? Those are the questions that your question gets at. We don't know the answer to that. But with the honeybee, the nice thing is we have this beautiful readout of the bottom line, what it thinks about the food, to dance or not to dance. Is it good enough to take up the time of the nest mates with this encoded waggle dance, or is it, I'll go out and find something else?
Yeah, I guess that just I think, you know, if the bee, I know I'm anthropomorphizing here. If the bee goes out and finds this fantastic, what it thinks is a fantastic food source, comes back, nobody's interested. Then does the bee think, well, maybe that wasn't as great as I thought it was, or are bees not even capable of that?
We have no idea.
We
don't know. But it's possible to test the influence of those factors, and at least on the output, which is the dance. And mm-hmm. the mental processes that go into that are not accessible to experimentation.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that you will continue with this research, and there will be interesting things to be learned in the future. I know we got to let you go, so we will leave it at that. Thanks very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Our guest, Gene Robinson. He is the G. Ahrens Professor of Integrative Biology. He's Professor of Entomology and Director of the Neuroscience Program at the U of I, also theme leader and professor at the Institute for Genomic Biology. Thanks very much.